United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Timothy M. Rice presiding before court number 23-191, Elwood City Forge Company et al. Versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names and firms for record, starting with plaintiff's counsel?
Good morning. James Ransdell of Casti Levy Kent, appearing on behalf of Elwood City Forge Company, Elwood Quality Steels Company, Elwood National Steel Company, and A. Finkel & Sons.
Nice to see you again, Mr. Ransdell.
Isabel Aldrin for the Department of Justice, and I'm here representing the United States.
Can you say your last name again? Did I pronounce it correctly?
It's Aubrin.
Aubrin.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you.
And Shania Lon with the U.S. Department of Commerce.
Good morning. Okay. And my team. Around.
Armed and David, law clerk to Judge Rice.
Hello. Good morning. Lily Folks, law clerk to Judge Rice.
Chrissy Menez, senior law clerk to Judge Rice.
And our distinguished interns remotely. Grace, we see you first, so would you start?
Sure. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Grace Penta. I'm a third-year law student at the University of Michigan, and I am externing in Judge Rife's chambers this semester.
I'm Hallie Green. I'm a 3L at Texas A&M, and I'm also interning with Judge Rife.
And they do amazing work. We are very, very lucky. Okay, so questions have been issued, and I think we're ready to go. We'll try to stick to them and just get through them efficiently. So Ms. Aubrin, yes? Aubrin.
Aubrin, yeah, it is confusing because it inverts the typical order of the R and the U, but I appreciate your attention to pronouncing it correctly.
Yeah, no, for sure. So we'll start with you. May I ask you to pull the mic a little bit closer so we make sure that we get every part of your comments?
How's this?
Perfect.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So on question 1A, will you start off for us, please?
Yes, Your Honor. So with respect to whether Commerce used or what criteria Commerce used to determine whether the merchandise was identical or not. This was, of course, a big topic of conversation at the previous oral argument as well, and where I was not, you know, government counsel, but my understanding of the way Commerce made that distinction was whether the Italian producers considered for the constructed value metric produced blocks or not. And the distinction was, were they producing blocks for the oil and gas industry or were they not? The four that did, Metalchem, OMR, Siscato, and Cognier all did. The two that didn't were excluded. Their financial statements, rather, were excluded from the eventual surrogate number. And that's, you know, that's both identified on page 14 of the decision memorandum and also reflected in the website submissions put on the record by Elwood in this case.
So Cohen and Siscato were producing identical merchandise.
They were producing blocks, yes, which Commerce considered to be identical merchandise for the purpose of this analysis.
Where on page 14 are you pointing us?
I'm pointing you to the second paragraph. Sorry, so I guess it starts on the second paragraph and goes through to the end of that section, the comment two section, where yeah, so I guess it's maybe more useful to look at the final paragraph on page 14 and the first paragraph on page 15, which reference the products both of Siscato.
It says blocks for tools.
It does, yes.
But that's not the identical product. How is blocks for tools the identical product to the full name of the block?
Identical insofar as it's a block made for use in the oil and gas industry. So it is, you know, I think it's clear both from the submissions of these producers and the record and the decision memorandum that they're not fluid end blocks. They're not precisely the same thing, but for purposes of calculating this metric under any other reasonable method, which is what Commerce said that it was doing here, this determination is consistent with Commerce's obligation.
What we're hung up on here, by the way, I apologize. We called one of the companies OMG instead of OMR.
Easy mistake.
We had a typo in our question. But back to Siscato and Carlton, right? Commerce had excluded two other companies.
Yes.
That they did not produce the identical. So it appears that it's peculiar that Commerce would include these two for tools, not fluid end blocks. That doesn't strike us as identical.
Understood, Your Honor. And, you know, I this is a point of discussion that has sort of been a thread throughout this case, and Commerce's reliance on these two, you know, on the Koni and Siscato data for blocks for tools, blocks for the oil and gas industry, is both all that's on the record and all that's then reflected in the decision memorandum. And, you know, we acknowledge that there's, you know, that there could be perhaps more detail put in the decision memorandum on this point, but I think Commerce was clear that for its purposes, those were identical merchandise.
Right. No, you're answering very helpfully, but our job is to figure out whether it's supported by substantial evidence. And here they are saying that these other two companies, OFAR and FOMEC, were not included because they were producers of comparable merchandise. And here we have the blocks for tools rather than the fluid end blocks. So that's what we're focused on.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And I appreciate that. And, you know, I think we're sort of left to make sense of the path between the evidence on the record and Commerce's description of it, which was that it was identical merchandise. And maybe that's made most clear by what it considered to not be identical, which were the products of two producers that did not have any evidence of making blocks, period.
Okay, well, Mr. Ramsdell, would you care to comment about this?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. So we agree that Commerce found that Koni and Siscato produced blocks. We disagree that there's evidence on the record that the blocks that were being produced are for the oil and gas industry. Tool steel is not typical to the oil and gas industry. It could be used for a lot of industrial applications, but there's nothing inherent in tool steel that makes it oil and gas related. And as for Siscato, there's really very little information at all on the record as to what those blocks are used for. But I guess to take a step back from that, we disagree with counsel of the government with respect to the standard that Commerce articulated. We believe that Commerce said identical and that Commerce linked identicality to the merchandise under consideration, both at page 13 of its IDM and in its cost memorandum. This is consistent, in our view, with the standard Commerce itself has articulated. We cite Ancient Tree Cabinet and several administrative decisions, paperbacks from Vietnam, light walled rectangular pipe from the People's Republic of China, that established that identicality means the merchandise under consideration, which Commerce itself defines by reference to the scope language. So it's not good enough or close enough to be some other kind of block. It has to be a fluid end block. And the last thing I'll say, certainly agree with counsel of the government that the details of what fluid end blocks are have been a ongoing point of discussion here. And it is very critical to emphasize that fluid end blocks are some of the most highly engineered steel products that exist. They need to withstand pressure up to 20,000 PSI. The nanometer inclusion or crack means a catastrophic failure, which often means people die. So it is not just a run-of-the-mill forged steel block. You know, this is the same as that. It is a very specifically engineered product that is produced with a great level of attention to detail.
Ms. Obrun, would you care to respond to that? And then let's move on to, were the court to find that there was not substantial evidence to support the finding that this was identical merchandise from the Siscato and the Koni, if I understand that's the correct pronunciation from Mr. Ramsdell, from those two companies, Would Commerce, as a matter of application of the statute, be required to exclude those two companies since it still has two, the OMR and the Metal Cam, where it can use the financial statements?
Yes.
And those do have, no one's contested that those two companies did produce identical merchandise.
Agreed. No, I think we're all on the same page that they produce, those two companies produce fluid end blocks, and that the other two produce forged products, blocks, among which are blocks, but that there's some there's disagreement about whether that amounts to identical merchandise or not.
So if there was insufficient, if there was not substantial evidence to support Commerce's position about including Cognier and Ciscato, then Commerce would be required to use the financial information from Metal Cam and OMR.
So I think, Your Honor, going back to the way your reference to the statute initially, I think that under the statute, Commerce would not be required to exclude those two sources of data, because the statute, you know, and Commerce, I think, was at least clear on this point that it was conducting its analysis under subsection 3, that it would be doing this calculation based on any other reasonable method, that it made clear why it believed the Cognier and Ciscato data were appropriate to use, because they produce forged blocks for the oil and gas industry. And that does meet the standard for substantial evidence.
But if the court, I appreciate that, but if the court concluded that this needed to be remanded because there was not substantial evidence, and if Commerce then reconsidered and agreed that Cognier and Ciscato did not make identical merchandise, would it then be required to use the financial data from Metal Cam and OMR, since it still has two companies that?
Right. So I think that if this were to be remanded, it seems to me the options would either be that Commerce put a little bit more meat on the bones of what identical means and why it believes the Cognier and Ciscato data are identical, or that it instead rely on the statutory framework alone to say, well, this sort of falls within the ambit of any reasonable method, and it's reasonable that this merchandise comprise the surrogate data. So I would see that as being the two possible choices that Commerce would have. And it seems to me that the limiting factor here is Commerce's explanation that it's treating this all as identical merchandise. So that would need to be, or that might benefit from further clarification on a remand if the court were to determine that made sense.
Okay, Mr. Ransdell.
Thank you, Your Honor. In our view, in this case, on these facts, yes, the court can and should order Commerce not to use Cognier and Ciscato's data if it finds that, in fact, they did not produce identical merchandise. Recognize the open-ended language of subsection 3, but as that's been interpreted by Commerce, they have consistently applied this four-factor test, the same one that they enunciated in this case. That's been interpreted by the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit has said in Mid-Continent and recently reaffirmed in Dohnkuch that the objective of that is to find a good proxy for profit, and I'll quote here, that can fairly be expected to build into a fair sales price for the particular merchandise, right? And so in our view, that here, you take that objective and you compare it to the four factors, and if we're assuming for the sake of argument that Cognier and Ciscato did not produce the particular merchandise, they produced something else. And in addition, with respect to the other three factors, Commerce did not articulate any respect with which those two sources were superior to Metal Cam or OMR, then it would be unreasonable. And that's ultimately the governing standard here. It would be unreasonable for Commerce to dilute a good proxy with a worse proxy. And Commerce has not identified anything in its IDM that suggests that Cognier or Ciscato is superior to OMR or Metal Cam with respect to any factor.
Closing on this and then we'll move on.
I'll just add that I don't believe the standard to be whether the data is superior or not. I think that it's whether Commerce has a reasoned and explained basis for its inclusion, not that it be superior to other sources of data.
Okay, great. Let's move on to question two. Ms. O'Brien, I'm going to start again with you. And offer an answer to the question there.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think here the customer base similarity does not require an exact match. I think that Commerce was clear on this point that the Italian producers of forged products that it included in its calculation all serve the oil and gas industry. I think that's reflected, or I see that is reflected on the submissions of their website pages and their materials in the record. And Mid-Continent in particular reaffirms this idea that, again, the source of the data has to be, or the data has to provide a reasonable basis for meeting that prong of the analysis, that it be comparable merchandise, that it be a comparable customer base, not that it be a precise match. And we might even say that it is, because again, it's the oil and gas industry. And I'll just add that I think Your Honor emphasized whether this represents a meaningful proportion of Cisco's 2021 turnover, and nowhere is as meaningful proportion that I've seen, at least, to be the standard that needs to be met by Commerce.
But does the record support that Cisco sold any of the product to the oil and gas industry?
I believe it does. Yeah. That's on appendix pages 2422 and 2425 of the record, of the public record.
Okay, Mr. Ransdell.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the last point, I believe what the record would show is not that perhaps that Cisco advertises to the oil and gas industry, but the information on the record, like from its website and in its financial statements, does not list oil and gas as a major target industry. It lists, you know, shipbuilding, it talks about stamping and those sorts of things. It might have some ancillary sales, but if nothing else, it's a point of ambiguity that Commerce didn't address in the first instance. We made these arguments, Commerce ignored them. And
they made a few sales or ancillary sales. Why would that not be sufficient?
So I think there was a recent opinion, Your Standing 755 F sub 3rd 1373. This was published after the briefs, but that seems to be sort of analogous and instructive in our view. There it was, Commerce was faced with some, I guess, CV profit options, and they were concerned with whether they reflected home market sales or not. So not the same customer, but we think the reasoning is sort of transferable. And basically Commerce found that the fact that there was, you know, some minimal proportion of sales in the home market wasn't enough to really satisfy the factor, so to speak. And so the court affirmed its analysis, saying, okay, well, you know, maybe there's a home market sale here or there, but it's not really enough. And therefore, we can look beyond and sort of, I guess, treat the sources as functionally equivalent in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Which case is this again?
I think Your Standing.
Can you spell this?
Your Standing.
Okay.
And then with respect to the question itself, in our view, it's fact specific, and so there's no sort of overarching requirement that requires an exact match in every case. But again, going back to Mid-Continent's characterization of the objective of this whole analysis, which is to find a reasonable proxy for sales of this particular merchandise, the best proxy for the respondent's actual experience would be sales to the same customers. So if you have an exact match in that respect, yes, we think that the reasonable course of action is to use that. And so in our view, yes, in fact, it does, where the facts allow it, impose that sort of requirement on Commerce.
Your position is we don't know from Commerce's IDM and the record whether the facts here support that. We just don't know. You're not saying that they don't. You're saying we don't know.
Yes, Your Honor. At a minimum, our view is Commerce needs to go back and look at it, and they didn't address it the first time around.
Okay. Ms. Oberyn, I don't know whether you happen to be familiar. The case was not in the briefs, whether you're familiar with it.
No, unfortunately, I'm not.
Okay. Anything further than on this point that you'd like to share?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Beyond that, beyond what I've said, and that the parties put this information on the record, and to the extent that there's more sort of explaining of what it contains, you know, I think I recognize that the decision memorandum gives us a sentence, and I think that points us to the material in the record that answers the question.
Okay, let's go on to question three. Ms. Oberyn, I'm sorry, you're still in the hot seat. I'm going to ask you to start. And can you take A, B, and C separately? We'll just ping pong back and forth between you and Mr. Ransdell on each of these points. And I take it that referring to Company A and Company B, since other information is not being used here, does not cause us to run afoul of confidentiality.
I don't think it does, yeah.
Okay, so let's start with point A, please.
So I think maybe the sort of helpful framework for thinking about all of this, which we discussed in our briefs, is that Commerce was trying to find an arm's length transaction that it could use for purposes of valuing this major input. And so Your Honor's question about whether, you know, did Commerce consider Company A's purchases in the U.S. to involve an identical product? That's not the way that Commerce approached the question. It started by, let me actually go to this page in the IDM. Commerce started by deciding which market under consideration it was going to look at, and decided that it didn't make sense to look at sales in the U.S. because that wouldn't provide an instructive transaction for purposes of valuing the ingot, and instead looked at the two data sources that did reflect sales in Italy. So it's true that the decision memorandum does not articulate a finding that Company A's purchases in the U.S. involved an identical product, because Commerce decided that transaction wouldn't be an instructive metric, period.
Okay. Mr. Ransdell?
In our view, Commerce did expressly characterize Company A's purchases as being, quote, of the specific stainless steel grade consumed in the product in the production of subject merchandise, end quote, at page 20 of its IDM. So in our view, Commerce did say it without any ambiguity whatsoever, that it was a perfect exact match.
Ms. Oberyn?
Yes, I apologize. I think what I meant is that didn't factor the reason I'll adjust my statement to say that yes, Commerce did make that finding, but that it ultimately didn't serve as the basis for saying, well, this transaction would be instructive for the major input analysis, because it was within a market that was not instructive for Commerce's purposes. So the fact that they were an identical product doesn't counsel somehow in favor of using that source of information.
Okay. Let's move on to subpart B then, Ms. Oberyn, if you'll start us. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That.
So this one, you know, I think that here Lucchini did not provide that much detail about the composition of the ingot, its ingot in question. And so the issue was whether it was a similar steel grade. And Commerce determined that it was, and I don't think there's a dispute that it was of a similar grade for purposes of making the determination of an arm's length transaction between Lucchini's affiliate and another Italian customer.
Okay, you've given us B and C together. That's fine. And I'll ask Mr. Ransdell to respond to both of those.
Yes, Your Honor. And one last point with respect to the notion that The product identicality was a non-factor. It is the basis Commerce cited to kick out the Eurostat data. So it was considered by Commerce, and they treated it as important, saying that, well, it's a basket category, and so we don't want to rely on that. With respect to how Commerce characterized Company B's products, it was not a good record for that point. Commerce said it was, quote, ingot grades, which could potentially be compared to the grade consumed in the production of subject merchandise, and otherwise said, quote, the record does not contain evidence of the ingot's chemical composition because Lucchini chose not to supplement its responses with information to establish that the ingot was not comparable, end quote. So it's just a situation where, as petitioners, we are given not a lot of information by Lucchini, certainly compared to what Commerce asked them to provide. And we're trying to make the best of it and sort of triangulate an analysis. And I think, you know, we appreciate Commerce's recognition on that point, that it was sort of the best we could do given the facts available. But we don't know specifics about those products. We don't know their chemical composition. So
it doesn't sound like Commerce. Didn't sound like Commerce knew that either. I thought you just said
that it didn't know.
So I don't. Commerce's a little puzzled here. You have an identical match per the actual IDM in the U.S. and a non-identical, or you don't know. Commerce does not have a position to know whether it's an identical match in the Lucchini Company B sales, and why. I don't quite understand that Commerce just decided they did not want to use the U.S. market for this comparison purpose.
I think that maybe I would put a little bit more of a gloss on it, but I think that Commerce, my understanding is that Commerce has a preference for looking at the home market. And here, for purposes of determining the value of this input, it wouldn't have been instructive to look at the value of the sales in the United States were, even though it was an identical product. And I just would add that on in the confidential record document number 251, which is Commerce's final cost of production and constructed value memo, starting at page 87652 of the confidential record, there's a bit more of an analysis on this point with respect to the BPI involved, which might be instructive for the court to take a look at.
Okay, so I'm firstly, I think Ms. Oberon, you've got a tough row to hoe, and you're doing very well.
That's very
kind. You've got a hard decision to defend. Apparently, you weren't here in front of Judge Vaden. I guess this one also had an earlier decision in front of Judge Vaden.
Yeah.
So stepping in is in the stream is always hard, and you're doing a good job with that. Is it useful to discuss this? Because we can at the end of this portion of the hearing, we can close it and discuss the confidential record if you and Mr. Ransdell think beyond referring the court to the page, which is impressive. That we should discuss it.
I'm not sure that I would have all that much more to add beyond directing the court to it, unfortunately, Your Honor. I defer to my colleague if he feels differently.
I'm more than happy to discuss if it would help inform understanding, because certainly the way this record was developed was a bit of a loop. But if the court does not have specific questions, then I don't know that I need to refer to the details in order to make the points.
Okay.
I apologize. Sorry. That we, you know, I imagine that this part of the record is also instructive in the major input analysis discussion. So we might return to it.
Okay. Let's see if we need it when we get to that question. Okay. Well, if any other comments on question three, otherwise we'll move on to question four. Mr. Ransdell, Ms. Oben, any further? Okay, let's go on to four. And here, The question is, did Commerce apply the transaction disregarded rule or the major input rule, recognizing that the statute does cross-reference them, but still trying to understand what Commerce did here? And Ms. Oberyn, I'd like to turn to you first.
Yes, Your Honor. So I'll say this, of your questions, this is the one that gave us the most difficulty in making sense of, because on top of both of us being new counsel, the analyst at Commerce, who actually was responsible for this.
So Ms. Alon is also distancing herself from whoever.
Yeah. None of us take any responsibility. No.
None of us takes. It's a singular verb.
None of us.
I do this annoying thing with my incredible law clerks. So
I appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Right. So I think that it would make sense, again, for the court to either now or later take a look at those parts of the record that I referenced, document number 251 of the confidential record, where, I think in this, my best understanding of what happened in this instance is that Commerce did determine that the steel ingot was a major input to the fluid end block. And that was why it looked at these different prices identified by the regulation, the transfer price, the market price, or the cost of production. And as is reflected on appendix page 87647, ultimately determined that the transfer price was higher than the cost of production and the market price, and so didn't need to make an adjustment, but did undertake that analysis as instructed by section F3 of the statute.
So you're suggesting that Commerce applied F3?
I believe that is, yes, that is what it did. And I think that maybe some of the confusion about the transaction disregarded question comes from the fact that the transaction in question is one between an affiliate and or is one between affiliates. And so it makes sense to consider or be aware of that, I guess, which is what F2 speaks to.
Okay.
That's the most I'm able to really say about it, I think.
Okay. Mr. Ransdell?
Yes, Your Honor. So in our view, we argued this issue by reference to F2. Commerce doesn't reference F2 in its write-up, in its IDM, or in its cost memo. But as Your Honor's question sort of indicates, it does talk about market prices, right? And so I guess if I just take a step back, and this might get a little bit into Part B if that's okay, but F3 is more about cost of production, right? Are they getting it from an affiliate? Are they getting it below the cost of production? Whereas F2 is more about, are they getting it at an affiliate but below a market price? So they're different analysis with different benchmarks, and they both need to be set up and analyzed. And if I think if the court looks at attachment 2 to the calculation memo, that's 87650 of the confidential joint appendix, then you see there's a row for major input adjustment. There's a row for what they're calling constructed market price. But so we think, that top one with the major input adjustment, it does. Let's say, to the extent that they're analyzing whether the transaction value exceeded the cost of production, that's an F3 question. We think they did that. But the problem with the F2 analysis is that they're melding market price and costs. So they're sort of creating their own market price in order to determine whether the transaction value was above or below that. We don't think that's a proper F2 analysis. It seems to sort of combine cost and market price questions in an odd way that's not really explained why they're doing it. And of course, we think substantively it's unreasonable for the reasons we explain in our papers, but I don't want to, get too far afield.
Okay, Ms. Oben, would you like to come back on that, and then we'll move on to question five?
I think it might be best if we move on to question five.
Okay, good. All right, so here, the court is trying to understand with A, B, and C, is trying to understand the sequence of the filings and which what Commerce did and whether Commerce granted an extension. So if taking all three together, can you walk us through what actually happened here so we can figure out whether plaintiff's objection is valid or not?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think the first thing is, and Mr. Ansdell and I spoke about this briefly before the hearing, so I think we're on the same page about this, is that it appears our joint appendix didn't include the document that actually issued the extension. So if it would be helpful, I can certainly email you or provide you with a copy of that document now that we've got it. It is in the record, but it's not in our joint appendix. So that might be.
I think you can, if you can send that to Jason.
Perfect.
That would be very helpful.
Well done.
Okay, so. So give us the chronology here of what happened.
So the chronology of what happened is that the rebuttal comments were initially due on. The 14th of February. And well, here, I'll start with the initial deadline. So the new factual information was initially due on February 7th and the rebuttal comments on the 14th. In this document that I'll provide to the court, that deadline, both of those deadlines were extended so that the new factual information was due February 10th and the rebuttal comments February 17th. So those are the deadlines. Commerce at no point considered, I don't think Commerce received documents on any date other than those two agreed upon dates, nor did Commerce consider the submissions to be untimely or unsolicited information. This proceeding, I think, is a little distinct in that Commerce didn't solicit information for the major input analysis for constructing the this cost of the input until after it had issued its preliminary determination. And so this is sort of already existing, I think, in a somewhat unusual flow of events. And I think I'll start by leaving it there.
So the submission that's in question came in on the 17th, which was consistent with the extended deadline for rebuttal submission.
Yes.
And your concern, Mr. Ansdell, is that it wasn't really a rebuttal submission. It was new factual information. So you go ahead with that.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Right. And so I think the sequence of events really starts with, before the preliminary results, Commerce gave Lucchini five opportunities to provide this information. And they repeatedly said they couldn't do it or they couldn't find it. Then they give them, so that's really the background here. Another point from a timeliness standpoint is that Commerce asked, so the substantive information in question, which concerns, I think it is publicly characterized as logistical considerations. So those logistical considerations were something Commerce asked about in a supplemental questionnaire that Lucchini filed on November 18th, 2022. And so in our view, if we look at it sort of in the framework of a run of the mill, did they file it late question, that's the deadline. And, February 17th is after November 18th, 2022. So they were way late. But with respect to the deadline for their rebuttal submission, if it's properly considered rebuttal and the court disagrees with our view of whether it was in fact a rebuttal, then it's timely. It was due on the 17th. It was filed on the 17th.
Ms. Oben, do you have anything further on that?
Yes, briefly, I think. My understanding is that, the regulation only requires that Commerce reject you know, explain the basis for rejecting information, not that it explained the basis for accepting something. And I think, you know, at most, and I think my colleague, my predecessor on this case wrote this in our briefs, that had, you know, even if this was putting new information on the record and at the wrong time, which we dispute that it is, and Elwood has not shown that this amounts to that it was prejudice in any way. And you know, I think it's pretty well established that if an agency is empowered to relax its procedural requirements, and that the standard has to be that substantial prejudice resulted. And Elwood, by its own admission, in the briefing, says that it addressed this concern both in the and these adjustments both in its case briefing and in the briefing before this court. So, you know, I think sort of as a backstop, there's no error, even if information was accepted at the wrong time, but Commerce doesn't believe that it was.
Well, it has to, the submission would have to comport with what is to be contained in a rebuttal submission as opposed to new factual information, right?
Yes, and I think
that Commerce does apply that rule. If a party supports new factual information in what is, in any case, in a rebuttal context, Commerce would presumably reject that information, since that doesn't, right, because that would not provide the other party the opportunity to respond. Okay. Mr. Ramsdell, anything further?
Just a final thing on that point. We did put in a letter on the docket right after Lucchini filed this and said this is untimely, you need to reject it. We made the same point in our case brief, and Commerce didn't address that. They didn't address the timeliness question at all in their IDM. And as for the evidence of prejudice, I think the document I referred to earlier, that attachment to Appendix 87650, it's where Commerce incorporates the data that it draws from this information, and it uses it to reduce and, in fact, eliminate any transactions disregarded adjustment. And therefore, the prejudice is manifest and obvious. If the information was untimely and Commerce hewed to its regulations and rejected it, no problem. But here it is, and it is problematic for us.
Okay. Ms. O'Brien, the last word. Anything you want to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, let me offer thanks to the team. We are fortunate to be with the service of our security officers who keep us all safe and make sure that the courtroom functions that way. We're indebted to our case manager, Jason, and the IT folks and the audio video folks who enable our fantastic interns who are a little bit, they wanted to stay away from us way off in Texas and Michigan so that they would, I don't know why, actually, Hallie and Grace, why you wanted not to work in Washington. Maybe it had something to do with your other classes. I'm not for sure. But we're appreciative to audiovisual to enable them to join us because they really are super. Okay. So Jason is just suggesting, sounds right, that you can you file the extension, the Commerce extension letter on CMECF, and then also email it to Jason so okay. We get it on the record.
Okay, great. Thank you. Would it make sense to accompany that with a brief explanation for why, or just as a nope? Just
I don't need it. Do you need it?
No. Okay, great.
Yeah, just
it's confidential, but under seal, of course.
Okay, yes, I will confirm that. I think perhaps it is not, but I'll confirm that before doing it. Great, thank you.
Okay, and the rest of our fabulous court team and my lead counsel on the case, Lauren Ben David. So thank you all. We're done here.
We are adjourned.
Thank you. So.